Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are. It's Tuesday. Ordinarily, this would be Titanic Tuesday, and I guess it sort of is. But I would hope in the national memory and for a very long time that this day will be a day of remembered shame, abiding shame, deep shame, merciless shame. For this is, of course, the 19th day of March. This particular year, 2013, marks the 10th anniversary of quite possibly in the history of a long, long string of nasty misdeeds on the part of this country, that this day will shine is not the right word, that this day will live, as FDR said, in infamy. Not for something someone did to us, but for something we did to an innocent country, to ourselves, and to the world. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home online where you can find the button with which to stream live. It just says listen live, and it's that easy. Click it and go. You can find us on a number of platforms besides our own homepage. There are smartphone apps for TuneIn Radio and for Stitcher Internet Radio. There are online platforms like dar.fm and streama.com. We're listed in your Roku devices. Might take a little looking. The podcast address is under the subdomain for this program at whiterosesociety.org, and you can also get the podcasts at iTunes. The Horn is a listener-supported enterprise. Thank you very much to, and again, I reiterate, when you contribute, if it's okay to use your name, let me know so that I can tell people at least a first name for who is helping keep all of this going. But many, many thanks go out for what I thought was going to wind up being a very slow fundraising night. We try to raise $150 in any given evening. And we actually made that goal last night toward the end. And we are, all of us who have participated in this are deeply thankful for that. So instead of being in a $300 hole this evening, we start out just trying to raise our usual $150 for any given show. And that's a lot easier to talk about than raising $300 or $450. So thank you very much. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The snail mail address is as follows. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, that stands for Personal Mail Box, 318 Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. If contributing by snail mail, please don't make anything payable to Bob Kincaid. Head-on communications is probably the best way to put it on the pay-to line. Makes life a lot easier for boss man Wayne when he opens up the mailbox and there's not an echo there and there's actually mail, and he is able to send it on to the Horn Bank account, and we can pay more bills. Paid some bills last night, mercifully. Thank you very much. But by the way, another magnificent couple of hours of broadcasting, absent some technical difficulties that we are still trying to work out in trying to get Dr. Bill's signal more consistent. Going to be working on that tomorrow. But another magnificent 2 hours of consideration of the origins of this nation from Dr. Bill. From one day to the next, I don't know of anybody else out there doing full availability, interactive master's degree and upward level American history on the terrestrial radio or on the interweb tubes. So do avail yourselves of that. Ben Birch tells me he is working on putting up a new archive for Dr. Bill with a complete podcast feed and everything. So by all means, avail yourself of that when it's up. In the meantime, we've got a whole bunch of people subscribed to the Horn's Dropbox account, which is also where we put sound files for Ben to grab and for you to grab in the event that you have a hard time getting, you know, one of these any individual show, if there's a problem with the upload or the recording on Ben's side goes bad. It's always there in the Dropbox. And I wanted to just a note about the Dropbox. When you download a program from it, please do not delete the file, because that means nobody else can get it and I have to re-upload it. So just download it, but it's when it says, do you want to delete, say, no, really, I don't. Okay? We've had a really good response to the Dropbox, and if you want in on it and you send me an email, I will add you with an invitation to the Horn Dropbox file. And I can report to you, this coming from Jack in Shreveport, who had asked to be included in that. Just sent along some Dropbox feedback. He said, I wanted to let you know what happened with the Dropbox procedure after I emailed you asking for an invite, just in case anybody else might ask, and to let you know what happens on the other end, because I really don't know. I received an email from Dropbox within a minute or two, plus or minus, of when you emailed me that you'd sent it. It had a link to click on. Clicking on the link will launch your browser. It wants cookies to be enabled. You do not have to sign up for anything. I just clicked on the file names links that I wanted, and it gives you a button to download each individually. You can sync all at once, but I didn't try that. Dr. Bill's radio show files were from 50 to 60 megabytes each and downloaded quickly. So everything worked great, and I was pleased not to have to sign up for anything. No curveballs were thrown at me. And that's always a bonus. So thanks for updating us on that end of the process, Jack. So if you want to be in the Dropbox, shoot me a note. And if I've missed anyone, if you've sent me one, because I got a bunch and I tried to respond to all of them, but they all sort of come into the same place, bobkincaid@gmail.com. Let me know, and I will include you in the Horn Dropbox as well. To be fair, if you don't have Dropbox and you do sign up for it, it expands our ability on this end to put more stuff up there. So that means that the more capacity we have, the more stuff we can put on it and leave there for longer periods of time. So there, that's that. Now, tonight, program notes. One, Thursday night, I'm really looking forward to this because I know a lot of you people read him and follow him. Thursday night, we will have Dave Zirin on the program to discuss the Steubenville case that we went over in some detail last night, but focused primarily on the media response to the verdict, as opposed, which, oh, my God, that's a response. That's professional media. We focused more on that, but on Thursday evening, in a conversation with Dave Zirin, we will talk at greater length about the culture that leads to something like a Steubenville, or the culture that led, for instance, to the whole Jerry Sandusky debacle. That's this Thursday evening, and I hope you'll join in. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, author, and his homepage is edgeofsports.com. Second program note, I'm headed to D.C. You may recall that it's been well over a month since anyone's been to D.C. to work on the AACT Act, A-C-H-E-A-C-T, .org to learn more. Everything you need to know about the AACT Act is at AACT.org, as well as the means for, by which you can take action to ask your member of Congress or your senators, because we need it introduced in the Senate as well, to get behind this effort to end the horrors of mountaintop removal in Appalachia. No one else has a proposed law out there that would end the nightmare that is mountaintop removal. Only the AACT Act would do that, and it will only do that with your determined support. So AACT.org. And if you want to go out and talk to people about the AACT Act, nothing is better to do that with than to be wearing your Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt, which you can get at ColeRiverMountainWatch.net. Now, this isn't a big pitch. We just happen to have a lot of folks in the Horn audience, the Horn family, the Horn commune, got to keep everybody happy here, who have purchased the T-shirt, and they will vouchsafe the fact that, yes, indeedy, it is a conversation starter. Here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by God, Virginia, it's occasionally a riot starter. Yeah, I've had more than a couple of people offer to take a swing at me when I was wearing my Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt. And you can get that by going to crmw.net. It's very, very cheap. And wherever you go, people will ask you what it means. And that kind of opens the door for you to tell them about mountaintop removal and tell them about the AACT Act and get them active, too. It reminds me of something that Kevin said by way of an email last night. He dropped a line toward the end of the program. I wasn't able to get to it because we had a stack up of calls toward the end of the show. And Kevin wanted to know the particulars of Dr. Bill's schedule. Dr. Bill, of course, live Monday through Wednesday from 4 to, don't confuse it. I'm confused. How can you not be confused? Dr. Bill is live Monday through Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, except on the Mondays when he has a board meeting in the evening, when we will do what we did yesterday and go 3 to 5. That's the schedule as it stands now. So there we have that part of the process. Kevin also remarked in an email, he said, I meant what I said about the Horn and you, yourself. If not for your show, I never would have heard of the AACT Act. I never would have learned anything about mountaintop removal or the struggle of the tribes in Wisconsin, among many other things. So I hope you are willing to take the information about mountaintop removal, about the AACT Act, and run with it. Because we cannot do this without your help. And one other thing, I was reminded by our friends over at Earth Justice, who sent out a blast email not too long back, encouraging people, and you can do this too, and it's a great thing. Sit down and type a letter to the editor of your local newspaper, because you see, congressional staffs read the local newspaper almost religiously. And I'll bet you that most of your local newspapers have never heard of mountaintop removal. And I'll bet you that they darn sure don't expect anybody in your district to care about it. Because, of course, the coal industry worked very, very hard to make sure that that story never got out of Appalachia. We won that struggle. A lot of people know about it, but there's still a lot more to educate. If you feel inclined, and it costs you nothing but your time, sit down and write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper talking about mountaintop removal and asking your member of Congress to sign on to H.R. 526, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AHEC Act. You can suggest that your two senators sponsor it in the Senate so that we can begin to get relief for the people being beset by bizarre cancers, heart disease, lung disease, genitourinary conditions, birth defects, premature death. And when you do that, you will have the satisfaction of knowing that in the midst, in the face of a moral crisis of epic proportions, that instead of remaining silent in some perception of comfort, that you stood to be counted and took act. A note in from our buddy Taj, going back to my remarks about Patrick's Day on Sunday. He says, you're completely correct that St. Patrick's Day effectively celebrates the elimination of paganism in Ireland. I spent a chunk of time researching at one point. I was thinking it would make a really interesting movie. I went far enough to have spent some time studying screenwriting and bought a copy of the Braveheart script as a sample. The big difference, according to what I can find of medieval histories, legends, is Patrick was kidnapped from his mid-level Roman-affiliated family, probably as a teenage boy, by Irish raiders. He was taken to Ireland, where he was sent out to watch sheep. I planned to write him mouthing off at the local laird. I'd also planned to throw a romantic theme in here, where either a girl he liked or was betrothed to was taken into the service of the local laird, who then sent Patrick off into the country to watch sheep. Somewhere in there there's a "where sheep are scared" joke, but we'll leave that be. Legends have it that he was warned by the voice of God to split from his assignment as a shepherd just as men from the laird came to take him to be executed. He ran away and managed passage to France, where he got with God, with some early monks or so, then decided to return to Ireland. Somehow the legends aren't clear, but he was able to do remarkable things similar to what the mages in the employ of the local kings could do. Eventually he talked the High King of Ireland into letting him start a church. My link to the snakes is very similar, Tosh says, to what you mentioned. The snakes referred to the pagan-style flags, snake-shaped flags, of the pagan local kings of Ireland. I guess you would call them pennants, perhaps. Not pennants, P-A-N-N-A-N-C-E, but pennants, P-E-N-N-A-N-T-S. Driving the snakes out refers to the slow and steady, possibly violent, elimination conversion of these kings to the new religion of, you know, peace and love. I added the peace and love part. Tosh says, as my religious fervor has subsided a bit, this project has moved from the back burner into the cupboard. Yeah, I don't think the movie's a bad idea, Tosh. Lord, I mean, don't sit down and watch an hour of it. Your brains will run out your nostrils if you do. But if that goober from Survivor can make a botch of the Bible, which was, well, myths anyway. I guess you can take all the liberties you want, including up to making Satan out to be Barack Obama in a Sith robe. These are not the Kenyans you're looking for. Well, then giving Patrick a little forlorn love interest, I don't think would be out of the question, although Bill Donahue from the Catholic League might try to have you killed by his weirdo followers. Anyway, Posh says, I don't know how much violence can be directly attributed to the rise of Patrick, but the green versus orange conflict since the English set their sights on ruling all the isles has been significant. My mother's mother was right at the junction of this conflict within her family. I'm not quite sure how, but she was the eldest child of my great-grandfather's second wife. He had 17 children by two women. Busy man. And I suspect she was a Protestant and the older children were Catholic, as most Irish who got to the U.S. in the 1840s were. This caused massive conflict, which somehow ended up with her being sent to Barre, Vermont Seminary for 2 years. Am I mispronouncing that? B-A-R-R-E. Bear, Barre, accent grave over the E, pronounced xylophone. I don't know. I'll leave it to the Vermont contingent to correct me if I've got it wrong. Oddly enough, that would have made her one of the better educated folks in Vermont, certainly among the working class, shanty Irish, they called themselves. She taught school for a while until she met and married my somewhat ignorant Baptist grandpa. The upshot of the whole conflict was my mother and grandmother were anti-church, though my parents did help found a Unitarian Universalist fellowship. I didn't know about that. I didn't know that about the penance, that those were the snakes. Tosh notes by way of conclusion, with green and orange elements in my family history, I usually ignore St. Patrick's Day. Thanks, Tosh. Now, there are an abundance of stories tonight. You know that. But in the name of the legions, you know, in Roman terminology, a legion was 1,000 soldiers or thereabouts. But in the name of the legions of dead, both American military and innocent Iraqi, and on the Iraqi side, it's anywhere between 200,000 and over a million, depending on whom you wish to give the most credence. In the name of that unspeakably horrible bloodshed, that eternal blot on what passes for the conscience of the country. We're not going to run off into Titanic Tuesday, at least not yet. As was said in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. Attention must be paid. By now, considering the other progressive radio shows that have gone on in the day before this one comes on the air, I imagine there has been no small amount of coverage of this pornographic anniversary of cold-blooded murder, attempted genocide, certainly a raft of chargeable war crimes as thick as a ream of copy paper. And knowing that, I don't want to simply reel off the bloody statistics of George Bush's summary execution of Iraq. You know those. You know the number of dead. You know the mendacious and felonious lies that were told to get it started. You know how Colin Powell flushed his own career and whatever was left of his honor down the toilet to do George's bidding. You know the things that Richard B. Dick Big Time Cheney said. You know the remarks of the comb-licking, who was that creepy bastard? The comb sucker. You know who I'm talking about. Anyway, you know all of that. And while I am not often inclined to read long form, this rather begs for it. When I was out in Wisconsin last September for Fighting Bob, Phil Donahue was there, and he screened a deeply moving documentary called Body of War. It's the story of Thomas Young's return home from Iraq. And it is available out there for your viewing. I read something a week or so ago by Chris Hedges, a follow-up on the story of Thomas Young. It is called The Crucifixion of Thomas Young. Hedges writes, I flew to Kansas City last week to see Thomas Young. Young was paralyzed in Iraq in 2004. He is now receiving hospice care at his home. I knew him by reputation in the movie documentary Body of War. He was one of the first veterans to publicly oppose the war in Iraq. He fought as long and as hard as he could against the war that crippled him until his physical deterioration caught up with him. I'd been toying with the idea of suicide for a long time because I'd become helpless, he told me, in his small house on the Kansas City outskirts where he intends to die. I couldn't dress myself. People have to help me with the most rudimentary of things. I decided I did not want to go through life like that anymore. The pain, the frustration. He stopped abruptly and called his wife. Claudia, can I get some water? She opened a bottle of water, took a swig so it would not spill when he sipped, and handed it to him. I felt at the end of my rope, the 33-year-old Army veteran went on. I made the decision to go on hospice care, to stop feeding and fade away. This way, instead of committing the conventional suicide, and I'm out of the picture, people have a way to stop by or call and say their goodbye. I felt this was a fairer way to treat people than to just go out with a note. After the anoxic brain injury in 2008, a complication that Young suffered, he says, I lost a lot of dexterity and strength in my upper body, so I wouldn't be able to shoot myself or even open the pill bottle to give myself an overdose. The only way I could think of doing it was to have Claudia open the pill bottle for me, but I didn't want her implicated. Chris Hedges writes, after you made that decision, how did you feel? I felt relieved, he answered. I finally saw an end to this 4.5-year fight. If I were in the same condition I was in during the filming of Body of War, in a manual chair, able to feed and dress myself and transfer from my bed to the wheelchair, you and I would not be having this discussion. I can't even watch the movie anymore because it makes me sad to see how I was compared to how I am. Viewing the deterioration, I decided it was best to go out now rather than regress more. Chris Hedges writes, Young will die for our sins. He will die for a war that should never have been fought. He will die for the lies of politicians. He will die for war profiteers. He will die for the careers of generals. He will die for a cheerleader press. He will die for a complacent public that made war possible. He bore all this upon his body. He was crucified, and there are hundreds of thousands of other crucified bodies like his in Baghdad and Kandahar and Peshawar and Walter Reed Medical Center. Mangled bodies and corpses. Broken dreams. Unending grief. Betrayal. Corporate profit. These are the true products of war. Thomas Young is the face of war. They do not want you to see. On April 4th, 2004, Young was crammed into the back of a 2.5-ton army truck with 20 other soldiers in Sadr City, Iraq. Insurgents opened fire on the truck from above. "It was like shooting ducks in a barrel," he said. "A bullet from an AK-47 severed his spinal column. A second bullet shattered his knee. At first, he did not know he had been shot. He felt woozy. He tried to pick up his M-16. He couldn't lift his rifle from the truck bed. That was when he knew something was terribly wrong. I tried to say, 'I'm going to be paralyzed. Someone shoot me right now.' But there was only a hoarse whisper that came out because my lungs had collapsed," he said. "I knew the damage. I wanted to be taken out of my misery." His squad leader, Staff Sergeant Robert Miltenberger, bent over and told him he would be all right. A few years later, Young would see a clip of Miltenberger weeping as he recounted the story of how he had lied to Young. "I tried to contact him," said Young, whose long red hair and flowing beard make him look like a biblical prophet. "I can't find him. I want to tell him it is okay." Young had been in Iraq 5 days. It was his first deployment. After being wounded, he was sent to an army hospital in Kuwait. And although his legs, now useless, lay straight in front of him, he felt as if he was still sitting cross-legged on the floor of the truck. That sensation lasted for about 3 weeks. It was an odd and painful initiation into his life as a paraplegic. His body, from then on, would play tricks on him. He was transferred from Kuwait to the U.S. military hospital at Landstuhl, Germany, and then to Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. He asked if he could meet Ralph Nader, and Nader visited him in the hospital with Phil Donahue. Donahue, who had been fired by MSNBC a year earlier for speaking out against the war, would go on with Ellen Spiro to make the 2007 film Body of War, a brutally honest account of Young's daily struggle with his physical and emotional scars of war. In the documentary, he suffers dizzy spells that force him to lower his head into his hands. He wears frozen gel inserts in a cooling jacket because he cannot control his body temperature. He struggles to find a solution to his erectile dysfunction. He downs fistfuls of medications, carbamazepine for nerve pain, Coumadin, a blood thinner, to Xanadine, an anti-spasm medication, gabapentin, another nerve pain medication, bupropion, an antidepressant, omeprazole for morning nausea, and morphine. His mother has to insert a catheter into his penis. He joins Cindy Sheehan at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas, to protest with Iraq veterans against the war. His first wife leaves him. You know, you see a guy who's paralyzed and in a wheelchair, and you think he's just in a wheelchair, he says in Body of War. You don't think about the stuff inside that's paralyzed. I can't cough because my stomach muscles are paralyzed, so I can't work up the full coughing energy. I'm more susceptible to urinary tract infections, and there's a great big erection sidebar to this whole story. In early March 2008, a blood clot in his right arm, the arm that bears a color tattoo of a character from Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, caused his arm to swell. He was taken to the Kansas City Veterans Affairs Hospital, where he was given the blood thinner, Coumadin, before being released. 1 month later, the VA took him off of Coumadin, and soon afterward the clot migrated to one of his lungs. He suffered a massive pulmonary embolism and fell into a coma. When he awoke from the coma in the hospital, he could barely speak. He had lost most of his upper body mobility and short-term memory. His speech was slurred significantly. It was then that he began to experience debilitating pain in his abdomen. The hospital would not give him narcotics because such drugs slow digestion, making it harder for the bowels to function. Young could digest only soup and jello. In November, in a desperate bid to halt the pain, he had his colon removed. He was fitted with a colostomy bag. The pain disappeared for a few days and then came roaring back. He could not hold down food, even pureed food, because his stomach opening had shrunk. The doctors dilated his stomach. He could eat only soup and oatmeal. 3 weeks ago, he had his stomach stretched again. And that was enough. I will go off the feeding tube after me and my wife's anniversary, April 20th, the date on which he married Claudia in 2012. I was married once before. It didn't end well. It was a non-amicable divorce. At first, I thought I would wait for my brother and his wife, my niece, and my grandparents to visit me, but the one thing I will miss most in my life is my wife. I want to spend a little more time with her. I want to spend a full year with someone without the problems that plagued my previous marriage. I don't know how long it'll take when I stop eating. If it takes too long, I may take steps to quicken my departure. I've saved a bottle of liquid morphine. I can down that at one time with all my sleeping medication. Young's room is painted a midnight blue and has a large cutout of Batman on one wall. He loved the superhero as a child because he was a regular person who had a horrible thing happen to him and wanted to save society. Young joined the army immediately after 9/11 to go to Afghanistan and hunt down the people behind the attacks. He did not oppose the Afghanistan war. In fact, if I'd been injured in Afghanistan, there would be no body of war movie to begin with, he said, but he never understood the call to invade Iraq. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, we didn't invade China just because they looked the same, he said. He became increasingly depressed about his impending deployment to Iraq when he was in basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia. He asked the battalion doctor for antidepressants. The doctor said he had had to meet first with the unit's chaplain, who told him, "I think you'll be happier when you get over to Iraq and start killing Iraqis." That was the chaplain who said that. That's me editorializing. The chaplain, the follower of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. Right? I think you'll be happier when you get over to Iraq and start killing Iraqis. Young said I was dumbstruck by his response. He has not decided what will be done with his ashes. He flirted with the idea of having them plowed into ground where marijuana would be planted, but then wondered if anyone would want to smoke the crop. He knows there will be no clergy at the memorial service held after his death. It'll be just people reminiscing over my life, he said. I spend a lot of time sitting here in my bedroom watching TV or sleeping, he said. I've found, I don't know if it's the result of my decision or not, it is equally hard to be alone or to be around people. This includes my wife. I'm rarely happy. Maybe it's because when I'm alone, all I have with me are my thoughts, and my mind is a very hazardous place to go. When I'm around people, I feel as if I have to put on a facade of being the happy little soldier. Jesus. He listens when he's well enough to audiobooks with Claudia. Among them have been Al Franken's satirical book Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, and Michael Moore's The Official Fahrenheit 9/11 Reader. He was a voracious reader but can no longer turn the pages of a book. He finds some solace in the French film The Untouchables about a paraplegic and his caregiver, and The Sessions, a film based on an essay by the paralyzed poet Mark O'Brien. to recover the page. Here we go. Young, when he was in a wheelchair, found that many people behaved as if he was mentally disabled or not even there. When he was being fitted for a tuxedo for a friend's wedding, the salesman turned to his mother. His mother, and asked her in front of him whether he could wear the company's shoes. "I look at the TV through the lens of his eyes and can see he is invisible," said Claudia, standing in the living room as her husband rested in the bedroom. An array of books on death, the afterlife, and dying are spread out around her. "No one is sick on television. No one is disabled. No one faces death. Dying in America is a very lonely business. If I had known then what I know now," Young said, "I would not have gone into the military. But I was 22, working various menial jobs, waiting tables, working in the copy department of an Office Max. My life was going nowhere. September 11th happened. I saw us being attacked. I wanted to respond. I signed up 2 days later. I wanted to be a combat journalist. I thought the military would help me out of my financial rut. I thought I could use the GI Bill to go to school." Young is not the first young man to be lured into war by false sirens of glory and honor, and then callously disregarded by the war makers. His story has been told many times. It's the story of Hector in the Iliad, the story of Joe Bonham, the protagonist in Dalton Trumbo's 1939 novel, Johnny Got His Gun, whose arms, legs, and face are blown away by an artillery shell, leaving him trapped in the inert remains of his body. Bonham ruminates in the novel, "Inside me, I'm screaming. Nobody pays any attention. If I had arms, I could kill myself. If I had legs, I could run away. If I had a voice, I could talk and be some kind of company for myself. I could yell for help. But nobody would help me." For Young, the war, the wound, the paralysis, the wheelchair, the anti-war demonstrations, the wife who left him and the one who didn't, the embolism, the loss of motor control, the slurred speech, the colostomy, the IV line for narcotics implanted in his chest, the open bed sores that expose his bones, the despair, the crushing despair, the decision to die, have come down to a girl, Alexis, his only niece. She will not remember her uncle, but he lies in his dimly lit room, painkillers flowing into his broken body, and he thinks of her. He does not know exactly when he will die, but it must be before her second birthday, in June. He will not mar that day with his death. And though he is an atheist, though he believes that there is nothing after death, that, as he says, the body is like a toy that runs out of batteries, only there are no replacements, his final act honors the promise of Alexis's life. "As he spoke to me softly of this child, it hurts even now," he said, "to know that she will grow up without him. I wondered, sitting next to him on his bed, if he saw it, the glory of it. His final bow, not before the specter of death, but the sanctity of her life, the resurrection." It is difficult not to sit here, and I won't even attempt it. It is difficult not to sit here and pretend not to simply hate George Bush and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and the whole filthy, literally, if he exists, godforsaken crew that cooked up this now 10-year-old debacle. One usually reserves one's fondest wishes and hopes for the well-being of one's loved ones, one's family, and mine are so reserved. But not far down the list is my fondest hope, among my fondest hopes, is that someday, somehow, million to one, Powerball lottery odds to one against, that someday George Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell will know justice. The human coin has on its face mercy, and on its obverse, or on its reverse, on the other side of the coin is justice. Mercy and justice. George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, and that blood-sodden crew are fully entitled plank owners, as the saying goes, of justice. And they are entitled to every bit of the mercy that they showed to human beings in their hundreds of thousands. Perhaps even in their million in Iraq. They are entitled to precisely that much mercy, and the quantum of that mercy is, of course, zero.
Happen here. print the truth, you lose your job. The thing will make it safe for you. It's death for many, riches for the few. And you say that it can never happen here. And you say that it can never happen here.
Kuntz. It can never happen here. The album that's on is by the same name. But it did happen here, and it was no accident. And yes, the comb sucker, of course, Paul Wolfowitz. Paul Wolfowitz, who spoke to the graduating class of the United States Military Academy on June the 11th, 2001, when he told the graduating class, referencing Pearl Harbor, I can't tell you what's going to happen, but something is going to be happening, and the best you can do is be ready for it. If Dante is to be believed, the lowest level of hell is reserved for the betrayers. That's where he said in his Inferno that Judas hangs out. If that's the case, then surely, there'll be plenty of space for Dick Cheney and George Bush and the whole cadre of homicidal maniacs who started that nightmare war. And, of course, there were a lot of enablers in the Congress. The list really too long to recite at this point in time. Almost all the Republicans and way too many Democrats jumped on board. I saw a post on my Facebook page today. Apparently, our buddy Michael, Kid A in the chat room when he wanders in, was listening to Ed Schultz earlier today. And I don't know the precise context. If Michael, if you're listening live, you can certainly write in and tell us what that context was. Well, darn. I'm sorry, Billy. I'm told there's no Bob Kincaid at the dinner table. Well, I've ruined my fair share of meals, and this is probably not easy. I understand. But trying to find it here. This note from Michael. Because I guess Ed Schultz talked about this at some length today. Not surprising. And give it one more look through here. Oh, there it is. Michael wrote earlier today and tagged me on Facebook. No, Ed, I do not feel stupid, because I was not one of the vast majority of gullible Americans who supported the Iraq invasion 10 years ago today. I knew it was bullshit when Bush went to the UN and blatantly exploited the first anniversary of 9/11 to urge war against Iraq. I knew it was bullshit when Colin Powell waved around scary prop vials of anthrax and testified to the UN about chemical weapon labs hidden inside good humor trucks roving around Baghdad. I knew it was bullshit when Condi and Dick started yapping about smoking guns and mushroom clouds. And I knew it was bullshit when the weapons inspectors said, hey, this is bullshit. So if I ever hear anything about yellow cake or aluminum tubes again, I'll call bullshit again. If you feel stupid, Ed, that's your problem. Because that's a trend that I've noticed. A sort of collective, our bad, sorry, oopsie. Oh, gosh, the entire American nation was led into a war that was based on tissue paper thin lies. Well, we won't do that again. Except for the fact that there were literally hundreds of thousands of people who took to the streets in various places all over this planet to protest this war. And they are not culpable. You opposed this war. I opposed this war. And to watch a nation go to war when you know better is to know a level of impotent fury that few other situations can engender. You were there. You haven't had a change of heart. We knew the war was wrong from its outset, and we railed against it. I watched my World War II veteran father come near tears as I had seen him outside of immediate death in his own family over this. Because he knew, that old water tender from below the waterline of an aircraft carrier in the South Pacific, he knew that it was lies, all lies. He knew. Millions of us knew. And in that moment when the decision was made to go to war against Iraq on a pretext of lies that everyone involved, from those who wanted it to those who didn't, knew were lies, in that moment, I think we knew better than in any other time that representative government in the United States of America had died. And it ain't been resurrected yet either. It's still dead. And the likes of John Boehner, who of course supported the war in Iraq, intend to see that it stays dead. The only representative government we're allowed to have anymore is the government that is of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. The government that is of the Koch brothers, by the Koch brothers, for the Koch brothers. The government that is of the Carlyle Group, by the Carlyle Group, for the Carlyle Group. The government that is of Halliburton, by Halliburton, and for Halliburton. There is blame in abundance. Just got a blast email from Dennis Kucinich. He says, I've called for a process of truth and reconciliation. Good luck. And I mean that sincerely. I'd like to see it happen. Where those who were responsible for taking us to war are brought forth in an officially sanctioned setting, and under oath testify to what they knew. The American people must know the truth about the grave decision made by our government to go to war. The families of U.S. servicemen and women who made the ultimate sacrifice deserve to know the truth. The families of dead Iraqi civilians who died as a result of the war deserve to know the truth. 10 years after the war, Iraq is still in turmoil. 10 years after the war, the United States' financial security is threatened by the cost of the war, and our long-term physical security has been damaged by the war. How can we recover? How can the people of Iraq recover? How can the world recover? We must demand the truth. We must know the truth. Truth and reconciliation is the process. It has worked in other countries struggling with their past. It can work in America. Interesting. I mentioned the concept of truth and reconciliation on this program just a few nights ago. Seems to have a cachet of applicability, doesn't it? Yeah. Dennis Kucinich was right about the Iraq War. He said that it was a pack of lies. And guess what? It was a pack of lies. Interestingly, however, when the for-profit media got a chance to discuss it, they asked him whether he had ever seen a UFO. For-profit media, what would we do without you? I know what. We might begin to draw to rebuild a structure of moral, ethical journalism to replace the cheap stenographers that the Fourth Estate proved itself to be in large measure, not in its entirety, but in large measure during the shameful run-up to that filthy, blood-sodden disaster. But it does bear remembering that people, in the face of withering criticism, in the face of howling calls for the head of Iraq, spit it upon a pike, it does bear remembering true, Piedra. Truth and Reconciliation for the Native American Genocide and Chattel Slavery. I want Dennis to call for that. I'll join in that call. Because the fact of the matter is, the entirety of the American experience, as it is called, begs for truth and reconciliation. We need truth and reconciliation for the entire existence of this country. And that is not to say, that's not being anti-American, that's about as pro-American as you get, because going on our present course, in the not-too-distant future, there will not be an America anymore, a United States of America. We have a government that is dominated by people who do not believe in government. We live in a country in which one side, one political party, is single-mindedly determined to tear down the very idea of representative government. And the beginning of the war in Iraq and the prosecution of the war in Iraq shows that they largely have already succeeded. Thank you, Pietro. But like I said, it bears mention that there were those with the courage to speak out straight into the face of a country that was trapped in the most miserable, hellish folds of a war fervor. It deserves to be remembered. It deserves to be noted. Attention must be paid.
Will come within a few days. I think it's important, Mr. Speaker, for us to be able to make the case to the American people as to why it's not appropriate for this country to go to war, and to encourage the American people to call their members to make sure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people does prevail. The members who join me today, members for whom I have the greatest gratitude, include Representatives Corinne Brown, Sherrod Brown, Capuano, Clayton, Conyers, Danny Davis, DeFazio, Christensen, Doggett, Farr, Filner, Jackson Lee, Captor, Moran, Olver, Rivers, Sanders, Serrano, Schakowsky, Solis, Tubbs-Jones, Waters, what?
That place.
For the Speaker, you bet I'll suspend.
Pursuant to Clause 11 of Rule 1, the Chair announces the appointment of managers of the part of the House and the Conference on the Bill H.R. 4. The gentleman from Wyoming, Mrs. Cuban, is appointed, in addition to the appointment from other committees and resources, for the consideration of the House Bill and Senate Amendment and modifications committed to conference. Yield back to the gentleman from Ohio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To continue the list, we had Representatives Solis, Tubbs-Jones, Waters, Watson, and Woolsey. And one after another, they came before the national press to make their case as to why this Congress should vote against any resolution which would put us on a path towards war. And one after another, in front of the National Press Corps, they called out to the American people to tell the American people to make sure that they called their members of Congress, that if they didn't want war, these members told the National Press Corps that if the American people do not want war, call your congressman. So, Mr. Speaker, today I intend to do a number of things. I intend to present to this Congress an analysis of the joint resolution which was offered to this Congress. And after presenting that analysis, I want to put in perspective where we are in this moment in history. The resolution which this Congress is facing says, whereas in 1990, in response to Iraq's war of aggression against an illegal occupation of Kuwait, the United States forged a coalition of nations to liberate Kuwait and its people in order to defend national security of the United States and enforce United Nations Security Council resolutions relating to Iraq. The American people need to know that the key issue here is that in the Persian Gulf War, there was an international coalition. World support was for protecting Kuwait. There is no world support for invading Iraq. The resolution goes on to say, whereas after the liberation of Kuwait in 1991, Iraq entered into a United Nations-sponsored ceasefire agreement pursuant to which Iraq unequivocally agreed, among other things, to eliminate its nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons programs and the means to deliver and develop them, and to end its support for international terrorism. Whereas the efforts of international weapons inspectors, United States intelligence agencies, and Iraqi defectors led to the discovery that Iraq has large stockpiles of chemical weapons and a large-scale biological weapons program, and that Iraq had an advanced nuclear weapons development program that was much closer to producing a nuclear weapons program than intelligence reporting had previously indicated. But the key issue here, the American people need to know, is that UN inspection teams identified and destroyed nearly all such weapons. A lead inspector, Scott Ritter, said that he believes that nearly all other weapons not found were destroyed in the Gulf War. Furthermore, according to a published report in the Washington Post, the Central Intelligence Agency Yes, the Central Intelligence Agency has no up-to-date, accurate report on Iraq's capabilities of weapons of mass destruction. The resolution that is presented to this Congress says, whereas Iraq, in direct and flagrant violation of the ceasefire, attempted to thwart the efforts of weapons inspectors to identify and destroy Iraq's weapons of mass destruction stockpiles and development capabilities, which finally resulted in the withdrawal of inspectors from Iraq on October 31, 1998. What the American people need to know, and the key issue here, is that the Iraqi deceptions always failed. The inspectors always figured out what Iraq was doing. It was the United States that withdrew from the inspections in 1998. And the United States then launched a cruise missile attack against Iraq 48 hours after the inspectors left. And it is the United States, in advance of a military strike, the U.S. continues to thwart, and this is the administration's word, weapons inspections. Now, this resolution, and what I'm doing here, obviously, is stating the resolution as a point and then making the counterpoint so the American people can understand that this is a capsule summary of the debate that's going to take place in this House next week. In the resolution, the administration contends, whereas in 1998, Congress concluded that Iraq's continuing weapons of mass destruction programs threatened U.S. vital interests and international peace and security, and declared Iraq to be in material and acceptable breach of its international obligations, and urged the President to take appropriate action in accordance with the Constitution and relevant laws of the United States to bring Iraq into compliance with its international obligations. The resolution says, where Iraq both possesses a continuing threat to the national security of the United States and international peace and security in the Persian Gulf region, it remains a material and unacceptable breach of its international obligations by, among other things, continuing to possess and develop a significant chemical and biological weapons capability, actively seeking a nuclear weapons capability, and supporting and harboring terrorist organizations. The American people deserve to know that the key issues here, there is no proof that Iraq represents an imminent or immediate threat to the United States of America. I will repeat, there is no proof that Iraq represents an imminent or immediate threat to the United States. A continuing threat does not constitute a sufficient cause for war. The administration has refused to provide the Congress with credible evidence that proves that Iraq is a serious threat to the United States and that it is continuing to possess and develop chemical and biological and nuclear weapons. Furthermore, there is no credible evidence connecting Iraq to Al-Qaeda and 9/11. And yet there are people who want to bomb Iraq in reprisal for 9/11. Imagine, if you will, a Cleveland columnist, Dick Fiegler, wrote last week, if after this country was attacked by Japan at Pearl Harbor in 1941, if instead of retaliating by bombing Japan, we would have retaliated by bombing Peru. Iraq is not connected by any credible evidence to 9/11. Nor is it connected by any credible evidence to the activities of Al-Qaeda at 9/11. The resolution says, and I quote, continuing in this comparison point by point, the resolution says that we'll be voting on the administration's resolution, whereas Iraq persists in violating resolutions of the United Nations Security Council by continuing to engage in brutal repression of its civilian population, thereby threatening international peace and security in the region, by refusing to release, repatriate, or account for non-Iraqi citizens wrongfully detained by Iraq, including an American serviceman, and by failing to return property wrongfully seized by Iraq from Kuwait. The counterpoint and what the American people deserve to know the key issue here is that this language is so broad that it would allow the president to order an attack against Iraq even though there's no material threat to the United States. Since this resolution authorizes the use of force for all Iraq-related violations of UN Security Council directives, and since the resolution cites Iraq's imprisonment of non-Iraqi prisoners, this resolution could be seen by some to authorize the president to attack Iraq in order to liberate Kuwaiti citizens who may or may not be in Iraqi prisons, even if Iraq met compliance with our request to destroy any weapons of mass destruction. The resolution goes on to say, whereas the current Iraqi regime has demonstrated its capability and willingness to use weapons of mass destruction against any other nations and its own people, whereas the current Iraqi regime has demonstrated its continuing hostility towards and willingness to attack the United States, including by attempting in 1993 to assassinate former President Bush and by firing on many thousands of occasions on United States and coalition armed forces engaged in enforcing the resolutions of the United Nations Security Council. The counterpoint of this, Mr. Speaker, and the key issue here, is that the Iraqi regime has never attacked, nor does it have the capability to attack the United States. The no-fly zone was not the result of a UN Security Council directive. Now, many people don't know that. They think the UN Security Council established the no-fly zone. It did not. The no-fly zone was illegally imposed by the United States, Great Britain, and France, and is not specifically sanctioned by any Security Council resolution. The resolution goes on to say, and I quote from the resolution, whereas members of Al-Qaeda, an organization bearing responsibility for attacks on the United States, its citizens in interest, including the attacks that occurred on September 11th, are known to be in Iraq. Well, the American people need to know. There is no credible evidence that connects Iraq to the events of 9/11 or to participation in those events by assisting Al-Qaeda. The resolution states, and I quote, whereas Iraq continues to aid and harbor other international terrorist organizations, including organizations that threaten the lives and safety of American citizens. The key issue here, and the counterpoint that the American people need to know, is that any connection between Iraq's support of terrorist groups in the Middle East, well, that, Mr. Speaker, is an argument for focusing great resources on resolving the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. It is not a sufficient cause for the United States to launch a unilateral preemptive strike against Iraq. Indeed, an argument could be made that such an attack would exacerbate the condition in the Middle East and destabilize the region. The resolution states, whereas the attacks on the United States of America of September 11, 2001 underscored the gravity of the threat posed by the acquisition of weapons of mass destruction by international terrorist organizations. And again, and I stress, the American people need to know that there is no connection between Iraq and the events of 9/11. However, this resolution attempts to make the connection over and over and over, and just saying that there is a connection doesn't make it so, because the Central Intelligence Agency has not presented this Congress with any credible information that indicates that there is, in fact, a tie between Iraq and 9/11, between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, or Iraq and the anthrax attacks on this capital. And if we are to go to war against any nation, and I oppose us doing this in this case, we ought not be taking such action in retaliation, and ought not put it in a document like this in retaliation, attacking a nation that had nothing to do with 9/11.
Mr. Kucinich's speech continues for another 40 minutes. And if nothing else, it is an indictment. It could serve as an indictment. When you think about the blood and treasure lost in George Bush's phony, baloney, weird, Oedipally driven urge for war, you got to wonder what kind of economist Osama bin Laden had working for him, because he said at the outset that his goal was to destroy the economy of the United States. Guess what? He succeeded. He must have done some giggling somewhere along the way during the Iraq War, watching us pour our entire being into stomping the guts out of a country that had nothing to do with him, and nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, nothing to do with September 11th. If there is any justice to history, Dennis Kucinich's 55 minutes spent on the floor of the House in October 2002. He said these things in October 2002. And fully 5 months later, the American people, lied to, were still in a blood fury to go kill a people who had nothing to do with the origins of their grief in 2001. On the other side of the Capitol, one man stood up, stood alone, as Dennis Kucinich did, watching his cherished institution give up on the idea of separation of powers, give up on the idea of representative government, give up on ideas of both mercy and justice. I have issues with him on other in other arenas, but if for no other reason, This moment is the lasting legacy of Robert C. Byrd.
Madam President.
Senator from West Virginia.
Madam President, may we have order?
The Senate will be in order.
I believe in this great and beautiful country. I have studied its roots. I have gloried in the wisdom of its magnificent Constitution. And its inimitable history. I have marveled at the wisdom of its founders and its framers. Generation after generation of Americans has understood the lofty ideals that underlie our great republic. I have been inspired by the story of their sacrifice and their strength. But today, I weep for my country. I have watched the events of recent months with a heavy, heavy heart. No more is the image of America one of strong yet benevolent peacekeeper. The image of America, Madam President, has changed. Around the globe, our friends mistrust us. Our word is disputed. Our intentions are questioned. Instead of reasoning with those with whom we disagree, we demand obedience or threaten recrimination. Instead of isolating Saddam Hussein, we seem to have succeeded in isolating ourselves. We proclaim a new doctrine of preemption, which is understood by few, but feared by many. We say that the United States has the right to turn its firepower on any corner of the globe which might be suspect in the war on terrorism. We assert that right without the sanction of any international body. As a result, the world has become a much more dangerous place. We flaunt our superpower status with arrogance. We treat UN Security Council members like ingrates who offend our princely dignity by lifting their heads from the carpet. Valuable alliances are split. After the war has ended, the United States will have to rebuild much more than the country of Iraq. We will have to rebuild America's image around the globe. The case that this administration tries to make to justify its fixation with war is tainted by charges of falsified documents and circumstantial evidence. We cannot convince the world of the necessity of this war for one simple reason. This is not a war of necessity, but a war of choice. There is no credible information to connect Saddam Hussein to 9/11, at least up to this point. The Twin Towers fell because a worldwide terrorist group, Al-Qaeda, with cells in more than 60 nations, struck at our wealth and our influence by turning our own planes into missiles, one of which would likely have slammed into the dome of this beautiful capital, except for the brave sacrifice of some of the passengers who were on board that plane. The brutality seen on September 11 and in other terrorist attacks we have witnessed around the globe are the violent and desperate efforts by extremists to stop the daily encroachment of Western values upon their cultures. That is what we fight. It is a force not confined to territorial borders. It is a shadowy entity with many faces, many names, and many addresses. But this administration has directed all of the anger, fear, and grief which emerged from the ashes of the Twin Towers and a twisted metal of the Pentagon towards a tangible villain. One we can see and hate and attack. And villain he is. But he is the wrong villain. And this is the wrong war. If we attack Saddam Hussein, we will probably drive him from power. But the zeal of our friends to assist our global war on terrorism may have already taken flight. The general unease surrounding this war is not just to orange alert. There is a pervasive sense of rush and risk and too many questions unanswered. How long will we be in Iraq? What will be the cost? What is the ultimate mission? How great is the danger here at home? A pall has fallen over the Senate chamber. We avoid our solemn duty to debate the one topic on the minds of all Americans, even while scores of thousands of our sons and daughters faithfully do their duty in Iraq. What is happening to this country? My country, your country, our country. When did we become a nation that ignores and berates our friends? And calls them irrelevant? When did we decide to risk undermining international order by adopting a radical and doctrinaire approach to using our awesome military might? How can we abandon diplomatic efforts when the turmoil in the world cries out? For diplomacy. Why can this president not seem to see that America's true power lies not in its will to intimidate, but in its ability to inspire? War appears inevitable. But I continue to hope that the cloud will lift. Perhaps Saddam will yet turn tail and run. Perhaps reason will somehow still prevail. I, along with millions, scores of millions of Americans will pray for the safety of our troops, for the innocent civilians, women, children, babies, old and young, crippled, deformed, sick in Iraq. And for the security of our homeland. May God continue to bless the United States of America in the troubled days ahead. And may we somehow recapture the vision which for the present eludes us. Madam President, I yield the floor and suggest the absence of a quorum.
Clerk will call the roll. Expressions of approval or disapproval are not permitted.
Oh, hell no, Liddy Dole, you bloodthirsty, warmongering old bat. No, no, we can't have anybody applauding the one man who was willing to speak up against the bloodthirsty monkey in the White House. Oh, no, Liddy Dole. Oh, no. Oh, no. But we know what happened. George Bush ran off to war. No, no, he didn't. Just like any other time in his life, when danger was afoot, he sent someone else to do the bleeding, to do the dying, to do the suffering. And within a year's time, remember, within a year's time, he would turn out, or the White House would turn out with him participating, a humorous video for the White House Correspondents Association dinner in which he was seen crawling around like the worm he is on the carpet of the White House saying,
no weapons of mass destruction under the couch, Barney.
Remember that? Of course you do. It is unforgettable. And we remember as the war began, that beast of a mother of his who told ABC News that she wouldn't be paying attention to the body counts because she wouldn't trouble her beautiful mind with how many were dead or whom or why. Remember? Remember, of course.
You called her Judith. You called on our nation's best. You laid it out plain why our sons and daughters should fight. There was no question. It was all in black and white. And like so many, my son believed all of this. Without a shred of doubt, he marched off to enlist. There came a memo from a place called Down in the Street. How can this be true? What am I to believe? The flag-draped coffins that you don't want seen on TV. I had something that I'd like you to see. This is a pillow where he used to lay his head. Some old books I would read to him in bed. Here's a trophy from when he played Little League ball. Here's another day I spend staring at the wall. I keep the room of his things, but he's never coming back. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq? I need the truth from you, not from one of your paid hacks. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq?
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
side of the highway. Inscription on grocery store signs. Maybe 18 was too early. Maybe 30 or 40 is too. You get your chance to make peace with the man, or is sent down his angels to you. Mamas and grandmamas love you, 'cause that's all.
About 10 minutes before the beginning of the third hour. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. And in light of how I feel, having just played and talked all of that, which probably goes without saying is like crap, I want to take notice of something Waggy said in the chat room. He said, play the audio from a few exciting car crashes to cover anyone else with PTSD not still not triggered from today's and yesterday's shows. And there's truth in that, and if I have heard any by playing this, I apologize. the counterpoint to that is that what the United States of America did in Iraq is a crime. Were we some small developing country, the entire world would be all over us like a duck on a June bug, and people would be headed off to The Hague to answer for war crimes, crimes against humanity. Jim wrote in a little bit ago, and he said, Nuremberg Revisited. We're not the trials at Nuremberg about truth and reconciliation. I can imagine the opening remarks of the prosecution so echoed in history by Mr. Jackson in 1946. With burning sorrow. Jim. Thank you for the kind words you have emailed in about this. All I can say is that those of us who had the courage to oppose the Iraq War, those of us who marched, those of us who attended vigils, those of us who stood for peace, have not only the right, but the duty to continue to call to account those people in leadership and everyday life who drove this nation relentlessly to murder. We must remember it again and again and again. Sergi, who is very patient, is with us, and I will tell you that the lines are open, 304-658-3333. I think it valuable, honorable, and in fact necessary that we express ourselves on this day and that we commit not to support war, not to support bloodshed, not to support Russia's into corporate-driven exercises in homicide for the sake of quarterly profits and oil companies and the vendetta of one very, very, very tiny little man. Hey, Sergi. Sergi. Well, doggone it. You there,
Sergi? Are you able to hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
You
there?
Sorry, the connection's been acting up. But I'm wondering if I'm coming through clear.
Yeah, I got you. I don't know if you're typing in the background, but there's a clicking. But no, I got you. I got you loud and clear.
Yeah, I can only talk for a couple of minutes, but I just wanted to make a quick point because I got to get back to work. But about Steubenville.
Yeah.
When it comes to the media, or when I say the media, I mean everyone I've been listening to. I've heard the term rape culture being thrown around. I don't believe that to be true. We don't have a rape culture. We have a sociopathy culture. It's not just about rape.
No, it's a conscienceless culture in many instances. And I think, Sergi, these two things tie together. There was no conscience at work in Iraq and then what we dealt with last night.
No, there wasn't. And to be quite frank, the same kind of attitude that led these two, well, not just two, there were more people involved, but the thugs that raped that girl that night, the same kind of attitude that fueled that is the same kind of attitude that fueled the people to crowd those town hall meetings during the healthcare debate, as if giving access to affordable healthcare to poor people was some kind of offense.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of culture, if you can even call it that.
Mindset.
That leads,
yeah.
Instead, yes, mindset is probably a better word. That leads people to believe that it's okay for fetuses to be protected, but for adults to just wither away if they're poor.
Do you remember? Do you remember, Sergey, when the Republican primary pageants were taking place, and the bloodthirsty Republicans, the teabaggers, screamed for Americans to be left to die on the floors of hospitals if they were uninsured? Do you remember that?
I remember it crystal clear, because I'm one of those people that they would be okay with just letting die. I'm one of them. And it really teased me off how, I mean, it's like there's hardly anybody talking about it. And I almost puked when I was listening to your podcast from yesterday, as I said in the email. They were talking about how the rapists' lives were ruined. What is with this elevation of people to demigod status just because they're athletes? And I say demigod instead of God because of one reason. If an athlete screws up on the field, they're going to be treated like crap. So they're not completely treated like gods, but they're pretty close. They act like just because somebody can kick a ball around, that they can do no wrong. That's definitely not true. I've been stuffed into many a locker. I've been pushed and shoved and beaten almost to a bloody pulp. I haven't been raped. I've been sexually assaulted by athletes before in high school. That's the reason I just have to take this few minutes to call. Because I just can't stand people's obsession and special treatment of athletes. If it had been an average student that had raped that girl that night, they wouldn't see the light of day for 20 years.
No, and Sergey, they probably would have been tried as an adult. That's one thing that's being overlooked, because the privilege that attaches to an athlete is still at work here, because Ohio, I'm all but certain, has statutes that allow individuals 16 and up to be tried as adults when their crimes are heinous enough to merit them being tried as adults. I'm not saying they should be, but you know what? I'm pretty damn sure that there is some ordinary individual doing time in some prison in Ohio, and God knows other states in this union, who did the same or perhaps lesser things than these vaunted young men, as they were described by Candy Crowley and Poppy Harlow, did, because they were tried as adults and sent to an adult prison. We do that all the time. We do it for crimes less than rape.
Oh, yes. I mean, I pay attention to the juvenile or to the judicial processes here in North Texas. There are 16-year-olds who do nothing more. I mean, and I'm not saying that this isn't a crime. This is a crime. It's bad. It's not nearly as bad as rape, though. 16-year-olds who are tried as adults for doing something like breaking into a car and stealing $5 out the glove compartment. They get more time than these people did. And I use the term people lightly. And when it comes right down to it, you know, for a crime like rape, I'm starting to think, forget the prison. Give them a taste of how they made the victim feel. these two so-called boys, so-called humans, and everybody else who was involved in it but didn't get charged, each and every one of them should feel exactly how they made that victim feel. Maybe then they'll realize how heinous a crime rape is. Maybe then. You know what? Maybe I have a dark mind. I don't know. But give, you know, I'm trying to find a way to word this without sounding too offensive. Trent Mayes and Malik Richmond, everybody else involved, including Coach Jokic or whatever his name was, Jokic, I don't know. Make them stand in a single file line. And you know what? I'd be more than happy to have 15 minutes with each one of them. Just give me a Trojan, and I'll show them how heinous a crime rape is. What they did to that girl. It's sickening. Because I know there's so many thousands of other rapes that people have gotten away with just because they're in the athletic department in their school, high school and college.
Yeah, and I know that urge for vengeance and that fury is strong, Sergi. But I also know that it really doesn't reside in you. But again, that's that distinction I was talking about between mercy and justice. Justice would have been nice. And yet they were pleading for mercy. And they got mercy. And no justice.
Too much of it. My apologies for the clock, by the way.
It's a heck of a clock.
But basically, you know, and one final note before I have to hang up here and get back to work. We have to remember that they wouldn't have even had this light tap on the wrist if it wasn't for Anonymous. We owe a debt of gratitude to them for bringing this to light.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It would have been hushed up, covered up, and brushed under the rug. Under the big red rug. Indeed. Thank you for the patience. Thank you for waiting, sir. I really appreciate it.
Well, I thank you for taking the call, and I got to get back to work here. I've got a couple more hours, so thank you for all the work you do, and hopefully soon I'll be earning enough money to be able to contribute.
Don't you worry. Don't you worry. You just take care of you, sir.
Thank you, Bob.
All right. Bye now. Calling from North Texas, that's Sergi. And by way of elaborating, Isaac sends in a link just now based on what I was talking about with juveniles being charged as adults. Before the case went to adult court last year, a juvenile court judge ruled that Lane was mentally competent to stand trial despite evidence he suffers from hallucinations, psychosis, and fantasies. This link coming from Yahoo News, bearing out my point. Anyone who thinks that, and I know none of you do, that Trent Mayes and Malik Richmond were given harsh sentences, anyone like Candy Crowley and Poppy Harlow, who damn near wept over the verdicts. Wearing a T-shirt with killer scrawled across it, a teenager cursed and gestured obscenely as he was given three life sentences Tuesday for shooting to death three students in an Ohio school cafeteria. T.J. Lane, 18, had pleaded guilty last month to shooting at students in February 2012 at Chardon High School east of Cleveland. Tried as an adult. Even though he appeared quite insane. Funny, Candy Crowley and Poppy Harlow were not available at the time
to wonder about the ruination of that young man's life. This in from Kate. Moving. Nice montage. Sorry to say, I've heard this invasion so many times I can smell it. Nothing eases the impotent rage I have felt for years. It doesn't help that most of the folks around me still buy the bullshit. Protesting with women in black, working with disabled vets, trying to educate those around me, all for naught. Prayer didn't work either. I would advise folks to pay attention to the hysteria the nation rulers of the oil are expressing over Iran. The Persians I am acquainted with are bewildered and frightened. Follow the oil. Indeed. To the phones. Lines open, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Mark.
Hey, Mark.
Bob, I just wanted to comment, and I appreciate you bringing up the war and whoever whoever's complaining or feels slighted by the sound of the...
No, it wasn't a matter of feeling slighted. It's a concern that I evinced last night with all the discussion of the rape story out of Ohio. It is a recognition, Mark, that even in the course of doing something like this, we must be cognizant of the concept of triggering. No one was put off.
Well, and actually, I agree with that. But on the other hand, triggering one and not being able to trigger a society that's sound asleep or apathetic or hooked on perception of a religion or a drug seems to be a larger bell that we're all trying to ring. And in a sense of the triggering, I think our side is way more triggering people, showing them the care and respect and the acknowledgement of PTSD and the crappy hospitals and the lies that sent there. So the right wingers don't even admit that the war was a mistake. They say there's Americans to die, and I have never, whenever I live, and I work all the time, but whenever I hear anything on American radio, I've never heard which hover anywhere from 200,000 to a million. So I wanted to call out for and to reemphasize the aspect of rape. We can actually, and you did it last night, but we could blend the two subjects, which you just did. But 19,000 soldiers, primarily, but probably 99% females are raped in the American military. That's all branches of the service, I suppose. And they were just having hearings concerning that. And I did it last night. Before they hand you a gun, they teach you how to shoot the damn thing, but also what provisions that you're allowed to use a weapon in. Having been an 18-year-old who was a Marine of the Month and a Marine of the Quarter in Okinawa in 1977. An officer who was from Florida, I found out in retrospect, his name was O'Neill, grabbed me. In any case, he grabbed me one day and said, Hankins, Saturday morning, be at the Army at 0500, whatever it was. I thought, what the hell? Army, what's going on? Am I in trouble? I didn't know. So, but I was where I was supposed to be, and they issued me my 45, and I was actually the payroll's sergeant of arms, literally. But, but as far as use of deadly force when it comes to weapons, do train you in the American military. And also as a civilian cop going through an academy, which in South Florida in the 80s was at least 6 months long, which I do appreciate. I know they want to do it. They probably want to reduce an academy to constitutional law, no use of force, and make it a two-week course on the internet, and let Ignite run that as well. But they think that it happens to be a use of deadly force authorized use of force use of deadly force is an authorized manner in which to approach it if you can't interrupt the rape. Or if the person turns around and assaults you, you're immediately able to shoot that person and shoot to kill is, I guess, the language still. I just wanted to say concerning the war in Iraq and tonight's part of tonight's theme, I thank you as a veteran. And I also, though I don't pay dues to them, I did protest with Veterans for Peace. And I think one of the first things that I would mention would be if you go back to Colin Powell when he spoke before the United Nations, I'm not putting it on Powell because he worked for Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld, but when they showed the aluminum tubes and a concern with nuclear weapons and the few nuclear reactors I've been in, which is about 26 of them in the United States, there's nothing aluminum inside of a reactor building. It's all stainless steel and or steel and a few copper lines to bleed off some water in some spots, but there's nothing aluminum in a reactor building. So I knew just from a layman's standpoint that didn't make any sense to me. And then of course that was confirmed later. And then when I watched it, it was hard for me to watch because I knew they were, couldn't believe they were going to lie to the world. And I really liked Colin Powell up until that point as a person. And, then he showed those drawings and I thought, well, hell, I could probably draw as well as that. And I'm just one human being. That's not even a good joke. But then I went to, I caught Scott Ritter on Democracy Now, who was actually a registered Republican, probably may still be, and he's a major. That was our senior inspector that was detached from the United States to work with the United Nations people prior to the, under the Clinton administration primarily, in any case, he was the one telling us they have no weapons of mass destruction. We know. I just left there, but then they shut him up and they accused him of meeting with, young girls at a Burger King, and then they shut him up through the press.
I will never forget, Mark, getting to meet Scott Ritter.
Wow.
He came and spoke to the Seneca 2 Forum, and we broadcasted it somewhere back in the archives, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I will never, and the reason I will never forget is I never heard someone in the position he's in speak the way he did, because Question Time came along. And he said, I've got a question here that says, is the United States on the way to fascism? And he said, I've thought about this question a lot, and I've sometimes answered, well, maybe. But he said, I've come to the conclusion that we're not on the way to fascism. We're there.
Well, I would happen to agree with that. You hear Americans just... people that don't have much political awareness, or they don't know how to put things in language, and they'll make comments like, "Well, this is like communism." And I go, "That's where the people are in charge, or what?" And then they'll go, "No." And I say, "Well, who's really in charge?" And then I say, "Are the corporations are in charge, or is the government?" And people say, "Well, corporations." And I said, well, that would be fascismo, wouldn't it? That would be power of the corporate state. That's what Mussolini. The Americans, they haven't learned. Many of them don't know. And I think the ones that were starting to figure things out saw Martin Luther King and Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy shot. And I think they shut the country up for quite a while and kept killing folks. And that would bring me to the Pope. Ultimately, in this phone call, if you don't mind, and also Bain Capital. I would like to tie those two issues together, but I just wrote down a couple notes, and I also, another person, having been a Marine, I can read Marines like a book. I can tell what kind of human being they are, I like Ritter. He seemed like a squared away officer, what we call a stand-up MF-er and a straight shooter, and probably as Marines would say, run your dick in the dirt there. He's a big guy, wasn't he, Bob?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of guy there.
Yeah, I imagine there's a lot of, and the other guy, there's another Marine Corps general, General Zinni, had well over 30 years in the Marine Corps, who was actually at one of the Rumsfeld speeches when, apparently, if you look at the footage, And they may show it on Rachel Maddow's show this Friday in Paris. They actually will show his face because they can tell. You can look at the footage and see Zinni's face kind of drop when Rumsfeld starts coming out with the lies, which were sure why Cheney keeps going to the Pentagon. He was going to that group that the not the Department of Intelligence. It was a group within that DIA called the Office of Special Plans. And of course, I know that you know a lot of what I'm saying, but I'm just reemphasizing it to whoever may be listening.
Sure.
Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski. So they're cherry picking shit, and some of it's, you know, 13, 14 years old, 11 year old intelligence. So and so she goes ahead and retires, and then is able to protest honestly, and she's featured in some of the documentaries concerning how they just pulled a lot of the old intelligence may have been manufactured as well, like the Kuwait situation with the Iraqis throwing the babies on the floor in the hospital.
Oh, yeah, that was all a tissue of lies. You know, we didn't liberate Iraq in Bush War I, Mark. We liberated Iraq's oil. And it may actually have been Iraq's or Kuwait's oil, and it may have been Iraq's oil in the first place along the lines of the Daniel Day-Lewis character from There Will Be Blood, ironically enough, when he delivers the I drink your milkshake speech. Because if I recall correctly, the thing that so agitated the Iraqis was that the Kuwaitis were slant drilling down into deposits that were underneath Iraqi sovereign territory.
Right. And of course,
the other thing that needs to be remembered in all of this, you know, we talk about our moments of national shame and our moments of national penance. Let's remember who really started the first Iraq war. And that's a State Department functionary by the name of April Glaspie.
Right, the ambassador who was asked by Saddam.
He
was there, wasn't he? Didn't he meet with her, didn't he?
Yeah. And said, you know, we've got a real grievance with Kuwait.
And she
cabled back to him. The United States, after consultation, mind you, she cabled back the United States has long taken the position and maintains it now, or something to that effect, that we take no position on Arab conflicts.
Yeah,
we greenlighted Iraq to go after Kuwait.
Right, that's after sending Rumsfeld there and arming them for the 10 years prior to that. So what else was he to think?
Right.
You know, he was only led with one conclusion, with that green light. We have no policy concerning your circumstance. And that's the green light.
Shoot him if you got him.
Right. And then what did the liar's father say the next day on TV? This too will not stand.
Yeah.
And I went, you bastard. I actually, Bob, when I left, I was living in Woodstock, Georgia, and I watched it on TV. People were going, "Are you watching this?" Yeah, I'm watching this, man, because my life's hanging in the balance. I'm watching my life right now, and I was just waiting for my letter to show up, and it did show up. But I watched them closely, and I said, "You know what? I'm not so sure Saddam Hussein is lying. He may be telling us the truth." I didn't speak Arabic or whatever his.
Yeah.
But you know, but I said, I'm not so sure Bush was telling the truth. So here I am, I go to Camp Lejeune, and it's January, and after I kissed my 2-year-old daughter goodbye, and I think that was the most traumatic thing to me, was leaving my daughter. I think if I had had no children or no significant other, I would have had a different mental outlook. I've not really addressed it because that's not my reality, and I'm not saying I would have been less human, but I know having had a child and being 30 years old at that time, or 31, whatever I was, that it still today, talking about it, still leaves an impression on my daughter's 20, 24, 25 now. So, but when I, 15 years later, I'm working in Pennsylvania, Bob, at a nuclear power plant, and we're processing in, and the guy sitting across the table, and I think this war in Iraq is starting, the second one, and he says, "Well, we were drilling into Iraq. He goes, I said, well, how would you know that? He goes, I was there. I go, you're kidding me. He goes, no. And he goes, his son was a special forces person at that time. This was in the early 2000s as this next war ramps up. But I have read different accounts where they've drilled, 7 miles, 10 miles in, 5 miles in, and that technology is developed around the highways of Dallas, Texas, 20 years prior to that or whatever it was. Those were the things I wanted to mention. I was actually involved with the Marine Corps from 77 to 1981. And from 1981 to 83, I was a Marine reservist with the 33rd ITT, interrogator translator team in Miami. And then from 84 to 86, I was with the Iowa Army National Guard. And I, out of allegiance to the Marine Corps and being in the National Guard to augment my civilian salary, I refused to wear my name on my uniform. So the people liked me at the headquarters, and they used to call me Sergeant No Name. But they liked me as a person, but they also liked the fact I think I had the highest pistol score with the 45. And then from 86, I re-enlist active duty to 1990. In April, I get out, and in April, I go down to April or May. I get back to the United States, and I'm visiting a friend of mine. It wasn't May. It was August 2nd. And I'm in Miami at a bank, and my friend, cop, is sitting there at a desk guarding this bank, and he reads the sports page, and I read the front page, and I said, Tom, this is going to affect both of us. And he said, no, it isn't. And that was, obviously that's the day of the invasion. And it did affect both of us. Both of us were called back. Tom came after me, and then I went. But I would just make a comment about when I was at Camp Lejeune, the Marines sitting on the bleachers, There were hundreds of Marines piling in. There were civilians, and then reactivated in what's called the Individual Ready Reserve.
Right.
And these two, they're Northeastern Marines. I could tell by their accent, and I said, "What did you just say?" And they said, "Well, the Bush family. They own Pennzoil." I said, "Are you kidding?" And they go, "No." I go, "Well, I'm from the Midwest. I don't know much about corn, let alone oil." And they go, "But we know the Bush family. They own Pennzoil." So if you read Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty, and then he's interviewed on C-SPAN, and he looks at the television, and he's probably approaching 80 at that time. He says, they scare me. The Bush family scares me. And he gets Nixon elected in the Southern.
Yeah, he was the author of the Southern Strategy, absolutely. Hey, Mark, I wanted to let you know you got a note in from Kate.
Mm-hmm.
She said, Mark, it's good to hear you. Thanks for your insights, your information, and for sharing your experiences. And thanks for your service, Semper Fi. She says, P.S., I met Scott Ritter also. I was moved and amazed by his candor. Too bad he got shut down by the oil slime.
You know, I've never met Scott in person. I would still like to meet him and shake his hand. And I know he's got to be a big son of a bitch. People can't judge by my voice, but I'm actually a pretty big, healthy guy myself. And I know our Marine Corps officers are another caliber above the enlisted Marines when it comes to physicality. They're usually just short of being almost like the athlete engineers. They are almost a super class of people. If they're jerks, we really we're not nice to them either. But most of them are humbled rather quickly, and that's the job of the enlisted people, especially the sergeants and corporals. And I have a few notches in my belt concerning that issue. But that's Scott Ritter looking at him, and I'd like to shake his hand and thank him for his courage. But I thank you for bringing this up tonight, and I think it's really sad that I listen to a local talk show here. They have an FM signal, Bob, that goes from Lake City, Florida, practically to Orlando, and it's a radio station, an FM station that they play the Limbaugh 1 hour, then they play the Herman Cain, and then they have a right wing local guy from 06 till 10, and then all that bullshit and propaganda. And they bring in another local guy from 3 to like 6, and then they did have Savage, but it's 24-hour right wing crap. But you can call in here locally, and they shut me down today. I said, I know you guys aren't veterans, and I said, and I don't hold that against you because you perceive yourself to be very patriotic, but I said, could you explain how the war in Iraq has helped us? I said, I'm a veteran, and I wondered if the fact that over 4,000 Americans died in Iraq has bothered any of you, or do you still consider that not important at all? And what about the people killed in Iraq, the Iraqi folks? I said, I'll hang up and let you try to explain that. But and then they, and of course, they spin it all around, and then they end up making fun of me, and they claim to be patriotic. I don't have any special, I don't have any divine providence, having served my country. I don't consider it that way. But I served I served because of my mental, physical capabilities and my ability and my physical courage that I have, so others wouldn't. But now I find out that there is so much hostility in our nation, and I'll hang up so other people can call. But I noticed from 77 Bob through 81 on active duty, there was a certain quality of Marine, and I met Marines from all over. My best friends were from Birmingham. Another buddy, Tim, was from North Florida. Wonderful, peaceful people, but there were Tim especially was a tough customer. But there was a softness there, even though there was a kindness in their heart, not softness, but a kindness in their heart for most of them. I don't know if because it came out of the 70s generation. And then when I go back on active duty in the 80s, I started running into like angry white guys. And I was like, where's that hostility coming from? There's no wars going on. There's nobody to hate. And I thought, well, Mark, maybe you're just getting older. And I think something has translated somewhere, somehow through our society. There's so much under what's the correct subterfuge, anger from, you know, generational hatred and
well, and also Mark, bear in mind that by the time that you were perceiving that, the right wing hate machine and the right wing propaganda echo chamber had really come into its own and begun to have its effect.
I guess so. Yeah. I think, and then you throw in the Stallone movies, throw in the Schwarzenegger movies where they start, bringing back, you know, they make it all antiseptic and very, they take out the humanity of any stories. It's not like some of the movies you watched, even back in the 40s or 50s type stuff, they still showed, you know, care and compassion for even soldiers on the battlefield, but you don't see a lot of that. I mean, I would say that one movie that I did care for a little bit was Tom Hanks's movie, and he did the best that he could with that. And that movie was fine for me. I'm not a Vietnam veteran, and I respect the fact that they were put through a meat grinder, and a lot of people. And I here in Central, there are so many retired people, period, and you have a lot of people that have all their veteran stickers on there, and some military retirees. And of course, you had Jacksonville over here, and Orlando used to be a big Navy training place. So there's a lot of influence in the area. But I asked them, I'll say, is that your Marine sticker? I especially do it to Marines. And they go, well, yeah. I go, hey, they figured out what Iraq and Vietnam have in common. A lot of them say, they'll say it's a waste. It's a waste of time. But I don't know if they vote that way. I don't know. But I say, well, did you know Vietnam had oil? And then that usually.
That stops them.
Yeah, and then they had tin and Michelin's rubber plantations and gold and diamonds and of course a lot of brown and root contracts get ramped up there, and that's where that's corporatization of war really gets going, Halliburton today. But anyway, I find it interesting. We can talk about rape unto itself or rape in the military. You can talk about the war, and
there's a common thread.
It's just it's sickening. It's actually a scary. It's a scary shallowness. It's a hateful people. There's something scary wrong about the lack of humanity. That's actually no compassion. And the expression of compassion is still considered a naivete. So, I grew up wanting to give everything I had to my country, and not only was it not appreciated, they thank you for your service. But, you know, I've been getting on the Internet, and I say, you know, you might want to cool with all this patriotic stuff, because does anybody remember Kent State? These soldiers, if something breaks down in our society, may go from being your hero to a guy aiming bayonet at you the next time. So you might want to proceed with a little caution on all that thanking soldiers. It's not really realistic, actually. Anyway, Bob, I'll hang up. I love listening more than talking here.
All right, Mark. Thank you very much for everything you said. I appreciate it.
Well, you're the American that I left thinking about. All the values that you express, the sincerity, the dedication, the love you have for your wife and for your family, that's the family that I was going to protect, including my own. And I come back, and I thought everybody was like Bob Kincaid. I thought all Americans thought the way that we talk, and I thought everybody had a heart, and everybody was able to discern information and to rationalize things out, and nobody questions anything. Nobody questions. They don't ask. And I don't feel like I wasted my time. I've got a lot of good traits. I've got some bad traits probably came out of there, but they somehow have learned to make them work for me professionally. I can put a lot of pressure on people that are much younger than me through my size and my skills that gains their respect eventually. I don't need to be a tail of the hunt. I can be a bully, and I don't need to be. I don't want to be, and I don't carry myself that way. I'm humble, but I have been a job steward, and I can be very strong if I have to be. But I don't carry myself that way. But I can go to that gear rather quickly. So people mistake the tone of my voice and tell if they see me in person, I'm a different critter. But I don't like being a bully, and I'm not one. And I hate hatred, and I care less for bullies. I actually look out for the little guy or little gal a lot. That's not my style. Unfortunately, peer pressure does exist, and I proceed with caution with that, because especially being older, it's very easy to bow up people, whether you even try. So I'm actually a person that tries to bring, there's an acid and an alkaline, and I try to carry myself in an alkaline-type personality. I'm a peace maker, but I will lead from the front, though, if necessary. But anyway, Bob, I want to hang out and listen to you.
Absolutely, and, Jude just dropped a note, and she said there's a difference between a bully and simply standing up. So I think she's suggesting that she doesn't perceive that in you. And from Jim, I appreciate you, Mark, more than you know.
Well, I love you, Jim, and I got to go.
All right, take care, Mark. Bye now. Mark calling from Florida. It is about 25 minutes before the hour, a little conversation time left in the program if you want to jump in. Had a note from Kevin a few minutes ago, Kevin in Colorado Springs. He says, you were the first today that I heard mention the anniversary we as a nation should be in sackcloth and ashes mourning for today. Yet some on Fox say invading Iraq was the best thing Bush the Dim did, as it encouraged the nation. Kevin notes, with encouragement like that, who needs discouragement? Yeah, some programs, I guess, are segmented. Let's see. All right. We'll do the opening, the welcome. 10 minutes. We'll cover current events. Let's see. Hour two, about the 35-minute mark before the third break. We'll do 10 minutes on the anniversary of the Iraq War. I can't work like that. I'll tell you the plain, honest to God's truth. When I got done with Dennis Kucinich's soundbite and Senator Byrd's remarks and played a couple of songs, I was kind of ready to hang it up for the night. Not that I'm a quitter or anything, but how do you transition out of that? If this is something beyond entertainment, if this is something beyond a little audio time vampire sucking a little time out of your life, then really, how do you move on? So, further proof that I will probably never be worth a tinker's damn in the for-profit media market, which is, okay. More than okay. So unlike most nights, I'm strongly tempted when 9 o'clock Eastern time comes and we play the closing music to pour myself an iced tea glass full of brown liquor and let it do what NyQuil does for other people and just get up and have at it tomorrow. I kid. Going back to the phones in a moment, we do have lines open. 304-658-3333. Some remarks from Piedra. I love your show and look forward to it every day. Thanks for broadcasting Dr. Bill O'Brien. I appreciate so much Dr. O'Brien's lecture on the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation. With that knowledge, I'm placing more pieces in the puzzle to answer why this country is so effed up, as well as the underlying causes for why I've been treated like a second-class citizen all of my life and been led to believe that I am at fault. I've spent most of my adult life unlearning the lies that we are all taught about the illustrious United States of America and our place in it. When I think of the hours spent, if only I'd had a nickel for each one. If we lived in a just and an equitable society, what might I have done with all of that time? I don't consider it wasted, rather I feel robbed. CPAC and the rest of the white supremacist Klan parties that carry the banner of their forebears owe me and a whole lot of people a huge debt. I hadn't heard Candy Crowley and Poppy Harlow sympathizing with those rapists. The MSM trots out eager black folks to refute racism, and they use women to peddle misogyny. After all, if the words are laced with the right color or the right gender, what could be wrong with them? On Democracy Now!, Arundhati Roy said that she is tired of being reasonable. Ta-Nehisi Coates said that he is tired of the good racist people. I've been that way for a long time. Thanks for broadcasting. Signed, Piedra. Thank you, Piedra, for sharing the thoughts. And a little reminder here, 20 minutes before the hour, thank you, Sal, for getting us started on the evening's fundraising. We got to start, but we still have a very, very long, long way to go to reach the evening's $150 mark goal. So I'll leave it at that. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, and so too is the snail mail address. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Evening, sir.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Man, Mark really had to head it on the money. He made me start thinking a bit about my ex-father-in-law. And he was a member of the same young men's organization that Mark was many years earlier. He was on the...
I love you. I love your gift for a turn of phrase, Bill, the same young men's organization.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. He was on Saipan, Tinian, and Iwo. But when I got to know him, we'd be sitting up in Chautauqua Lake at night, dark, pitch dark, and trying to catch a few fish now and then, and he would talk to me about it. And he said, well, Bill, you've read enough about it and studied enough about it. And he'd cut loose and he'd tell me, Bill, I saw things that to this day I didn't appreciate that were done. He was a... Mark can understand this. He was a company runner, and that was a. But you should have high insurance when you did that. And he would remark that he saw things that he didn't approve of to this day, and that was he said it was you couldn't get more, after Pearl and such and the Nazis, you couldn't really justify doing this anymore. But he said he saw things done that he didn't like and. And he had changed quite a bit from those days. And when I hear Mark talk, it brings my ex-father-in-law was a great guy. My dad was a damn good violinist in the gypsy style, but they didn't take him. I tried enlisting in 61 or something just because of jobs. The Army in those days was you want to learn electronics, you want to learn this. Of course, we make a crook out of you, but and they wouldn't take me. And man, when that war got rolling in Indochina, buddy, they're over here calling me up. I said, "Hey, forget this number, buddy. No, you're not going to change my dress, Gaddis, if I have anything to say about it. But it was that thing, and I mean, I didn't know whether to wind my watch or what when that war started in Iraq, and I kind of thought highly of old man Bush and company because of what they did. They just pushed the guy out of where he was, and you know, that was it. They could have gone all the way to Baghdad, and why bother? Why do it? Maybe they had more plans for this guy so they could steal more oil. I don't know. I mean, how do you understand what these people have in mind?
Well, and that's where we get into trouble, Bill, is if we try to approach something like this from the standpoint of reasonable, sane, non-psychopathic, non-sociopathic people. Because for people who are not severely mentally incapacitated, this isn't being mentally challenged. This isn't being differently abled. Psychopaths and sociopaths are dangerous and need to be, dare I say it, excised from society and put somewhere where they can only hurt each other. And that's George Bush. That's Paul Wolfowitz. That's Rumsfeld. That's Condi Rice. That's Cheney. That's way too many members of the House and Senate, and far too many corporate CEOs. And so when you try to use a
combat veteran in there, you know, the bunch you just mentioned.
Oh no, they're chicken hawks.
That's why one of the things I appreciated about a guy like Ridgway, when the Dulles brothers wanted to raise the siege of D&B and fool with including a nuclear attack if they had to, called Operation Vulture. And Ridgway, who was chief of staff, Ike gave him the things and give me your opinion, and Ridgway came back in 2 weeks and said, there's nothing in this for us. So every once in a while, you'll find a guy in uniform who knows what the hell he's doing and decides, Smelly Butler. He was another one who blew the whistle and pulled the plug on those guys what did he have, two congressionals or three?
Yeah, two. Remember. Two.
Two?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was the Philippines and Haiti or Nicaragua and Haiti.
Yeah, neither one of them. I don't know if he didn't get one in France, although I think he was there. But how long can what are we going to do with all these guys when they come home and there's no job? Those of us who have read about the Veterans Bonus March, for instance, there's a good book on that subject, and you get an idea. Because when you touch on in the school, you figure there was 10 guys that went down to D.C. to try to get their bonus. My ass. There was a ton of guys from all over the country that went down there. And they were there, what, 8-9 months? And MacArthur went in and burned them out and sent tanks into their camps. And, you just wonder what they think these guys are going to do when they come back here. And there ain't no job. And if there ain't no job, whose fault is it? And which way is it going to go? Bob, I'm clearing out. I'm at that age where I keep my bags packed, you know, and who knows how many of my relatives I'll be seeing shortly. Of course, at my height, I did everything that way, so. Anyway, I'll clear the line.
Jeez. Oh, he'll be here all week. Try the veal. Don't forget to tip your waiter.
I'll clear the line, but I just thought Mark would appreciate the idea that I had spent some wonderful hours sitting catching fish with a Marine Corps veteran in the dark and listening to his stories and having him comment on what I would say and say, yeah, wherever you picked that up, it was correct. He said he saw things that Pearl Harbor or not or whatever, they were not the correct thing to do. And a lot of guys hid behind the flag to be a cold-blooded killer, you know. I mean, after they had taken POWs and such and shoot them anyhow, you know, nothing else to do with them. Mark, thanks for your attitude about what you've done. That's the important thing. You, as Lincoln said about holding truths to be self-evident, you're doing it. And you take care of yourself and clear the deck for somebody else. Good
night. All right, Bill. You take care. Bye now. Our good buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, in his day or nighttime job from Cleveland. A little bit of good news as we continue the ongoing efforts to keep this whole operation afloat. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Kath. Thank you, Sal. We are now at only 75, what? Yeah, $75. $75 to reach this evening's fundraising goal. I don't like bringing it up, but I don't know of any other way to go about it. But that's more encouraging than, yeah, by a long shot. So, again, thank you. Thank you, you three. Your dedication to keeping this going is, well, very much appreciated. I don't know where to go to round out something like this, except maybe to make note of an article that I saw via the BBC. Funny how I didn't see a whole lot of American for-profit media coverage of this. Comes from a program on the BBC, BBC News Magazine, called Archive on 4, I guess. I don't get the BBC, so I have to guess. It came out on the 15th of this month, four days ago. And I mention this because of what Mark said about the similarities between Vietnam and Iraq. Remember, we were told by the Bush administration, this ain't nothing like Vietnam. Among other things, I happen to be president, so I don't have to run away from this one. Ain't nobody going to ask me to go and shoot and put on the uniform. But there are more similarities. There are, by estimates. About 22,000, by the way, a reminder, I was actually on air during some of the earlier days of the Iraq War over there on terrestrial radio. And I remember saying, that the memorial for Vietnam was a wall. I suggested that the memorial for the Iraq War be done up in the form of a giant granite oil pipeline with the names of our dead upon it. And maybe for the first time, to the extent that it would even be humanly possible, maybe we could go ahead and put the names of the murdered civilians on it too. To see the dead Iraqis, for the most part, didn't even give their lives in service to their country. They were just sitting around breathing when we killed them. But no, there are similarities between Vietnam and Iraq. It turns out that at least 22,000 of the names that are on the wall in Vietnam, well, none of them had to be there. None of them. But 22,000 of the names that are there solely because of the sociopathic, if not psychopathic, ambitions of one Richard Milhouse Nixon. By virtue of examination, not of the Nixon tapes, but of the Lyndon Johnson tapes, we have learned, or confirmed perhaps, that Richard Nixon was actively involved in scuttling attempts to bring North Vietnam to the peace talks in Paris
and that North Vietnam had been actively engaged in making a number of concessions that could have led to an end of the Vietnam War by no later than early 1969. Nixon sent a treasonous, double-dealing, nasty, nasty woman by the name of Anna Chenault, a senior campaign advisor, to the North Vietnamese, or to the South Vietnamese. Chenault was said to be Nixon's representative speaking for the campaign to the South Vietnamese government. All messages from the campaign were said to go to South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu via Anna Chenault. She told the South Vietnamese to withdraw from peace talks so Nixon could be president. There's evil, and there's evil. And then there's Richard Nixon.
How are you, my friend? Well, I've got one this morning that's pretty rough for you. We have found that our friend, Republican nominee, our California friend, has been playing on the outskirts with our enemies and our friends both. He's been doing it through rather subterranean sources here. And he has been saying to the Allies that you're going to get sold out. You better not give away your liberty just a few hours before I can preserve it for you. Mrs. Chenault is contacting their ambassador. Now, this is not guesswork. Mrs. Chenault, she's young and attractive. I mean, she's a pretty good-looking girl. And she's around town. And she is warning them to not get pulled in on this Johnson move.
Some dare call it treason. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree when it comes to the willingness of Republicans to put themselves ahead of the nation and of the very blood of the nation. Richard Nixon's another one of those people that makes me wish I could believe in religious mythology. Because I would very much like to think that a Richard Nixon is in hell and that someday George Bush will join him. And whenever that decent human being's heart gives out inside Dick Cheney's body, that they won't be able to find another one, and he'll go there too. Because if anybody ever deserved it, they do. Time to get out of here. And hey, we're now only $50 away from meeting tonight's fundraising goal. Thank you very, very much, Don. That's how we keep all this going. Thanks very much also for the time that you spend with this program, for the ideas you send in, your phone calls, and yes, the support that keeps it on the air. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to Agnes for help with the posts. Thanks to John Fox down in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. The only reason there's a horn to listen to is because of Ben Birch at White Rose Society. He makes it all possible. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch,
crmw.net, and ACACT, A-C-H-E-A-C-T, .org, ACACT.org, where you can become an active participating part in ending the human rights disaster that unfolds every day throughout Central Appalachia. A-C-H-E-A-C-T, ACACT.org. Join us tomorrow at live at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for Dr. Bill O'Brien and the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. You will find it time well spent and feel, well, it will be a rewarding experience. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. And Rick Smith is on the way on the horn.